Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.
When you make decisions for your company, you look for the no-brainers. And if you have a lot of mailing to do, Stamps.com is the ultimate no-brainer. It streamlines your processes to make your business more efficient, which makes you less busy. Mail checks, invoices, legal documents, and everything you need to keep your business running with Stamps.com. Seamlessly connect with every major marketplace and shopping cart. Schedule package pickups and see your cheapest and fastest shipping options from different carriers. With rates up to 89% off USPS and UPS rates. And with the Stamps.com mobile app, you can take care of mailing and shipping wherever you are. Make the same no-brainer decision as over 1 million other businesses with Stamps.com. Sign up with code PROGRAM for a 4-week trial, plus free postage and a free digital scale. No long-term commitments or contracts. That's stamps.com. Code program.
The Telegraph. The Telegraph. Podcasts.
Hi there, podcast fans. I'm Tom Gibbs. Welcome to Telegraph Audio Football Club. Today, England are forced to check their privilege in Prague. Is this an identity crisis? Will they fail to reach the latter stages of Euro 2020? Or, more likely, is everyone slightly overreacting? Elsewhere, Wales take 2 points from Slovakia and Croatia to join the two-draw cinema club, but can they clinch qualification to Euro 2020? Scotland and San Marino make an audacious bid to turn football into a water sport, and Mick McCarthy and his Republic of Ireland top their group impressively. Plus, a Premier League preview, a roundup of what's happening all over Europe, and the best or worst time to sack a manager. Let's take you now into the audio recording facility, where I'm delighted to say I'm joined, as ever, by Mina Rizuki. How are you, Mina?
Hi, I'm the only one that's still around.
I know.
The usual gang.
I know, but we got to ring the changes, Mina. It's important to welcome fresh blood into the AFC stable. One person we've got with us today for the first time in a while is Chief Sports Reporter Jeremy Wilson. What's happening, Jeremy?
Well, I'm pleased to be here.
Good
squad rotation.
Yeah.
Looking forward to the football tonight.
Yes, of course. Yeah, we're all looking forward to watching international qualifiers. and no JJ Ball, so we need two J's to replace him. Who better than the world's greatest man, Jim White? What's happening, Jim?
Oh, my word. Am I replacing JJ?
Yeah, afraid so.
I know nothing about tactics. I know nothing about where you play players. Oh, no. Sorry.
We've got to argue about Pep just to keep it fresh.
Yeah. Good. Let's have a Pep-free zone. It's International Week, after all. What about England? They lost a qualifier for the first time in 10 years on Friday night in Prague. They seem to sit off the Czech Republic more than we've become accustomed to, Mina. Was this a bit of a failure in planning or preparation or tactics from Gareth Southgate's side?
Obviously, I don't think that England were playing from all cylinders. And I think that the heavy rotation and the fact that you sort of don't know who your fullbacks are going to be, I don't think Keane works very well together with, Maguire. That's it. Sorry. I had a brain freeze over there. I think this is causing a little bit of problems with them. I do think the formation was very strange to go into. And I think that it made them uncomfortable. They haven't played the 4-2-3-1 in a very long time. And I think it's a particular formation that you need a lot of fluidity and understanding in between the players. Now, what was interesting is when you look at that, you thought you had four sort of attacking players with Mason Mount as a man in the hole, almost. And then you have, you know, Rice and Henderson having to do so much work in midfield. I think it's unfamiliar, considering they're unfamiliar set of players in the sense that all of them are from different clubs. You have Danny Rose and Harry Kane, who know each other, so there's some sort of familiarity over there. But otherwise, when you look at the way that the team is set up, you just don't... there isn't sort of a backbone from a club. There isn't a backbone from a team that's at the moment doing very well. There isn't sort of let's copy Liverpool's plan or let's try to play this way and have a, sort of a core unit from one specific club. It just seemed to be a bunch of individuals put together, and I think that created problems. They looked better and more settled in a 4-3-3, but that's about all I can do on the JJ front.
I'm not sure the system was at fault as much as playing Mount in the wrong place.
That is also
if you've got to have
issue.
A number 10, you've got to have a number 10, haven't you?
Yeah, and who's Mount actually isn't. Very clever. Yeah.
And it may have been better to play James Maddison there, but he was too busy.
Yeah, that was a quite remarkable story from the weekend. He pulled out of the squad, and the England certainly made it sound like he had made the decision to pull himself out of the squad and then pictured in a casino during the match.
Yes.
Not a great look, is
not
it?
Not a great look. Not a great look. I think Mason Mount's a really good player, really good prospect, but I'm not sure he was right there. And that obviously caused problems in the first half, though they started really well. They scored a goal after about 5 minutes. And I think you're right. They looked more comfortable in the second half in 4-3-3, but it didn't really work, did it? They still lost. They managed to let in that second goal.
Isn't it a bit weird that you sort of have Mason Mount, who's played regular on a consistent level, high-level football for 2 months, and then you decide to bring him in, play him out of position, and sort of almost change the team around him to accommodate his creativity in hopes that you would be really good off the ball and on the ball? I just thought that that was bizarre, because it's like what you're doing is saying, well, this is a reward for you having done really well, but now if you do badly, we're going to like criticize you and say, well, we've got to change the system. We might need to go back to three. And I thought that that was a little bit like, I think England needs to figure out the identity. Are we going to the Euros in hopes of actually winning this, or are we planning for something bigger, in which case it's going to take time to bring in the likes of Maddison and Mount and actually build something? Or are we just trying to do, you know, what we did in the World Cup, which is sort of win in any way, shape or form and not necessarily need to dominate in midfield, but just make the most of our opportunities.
Certainly the most urgent area of attention, it would seem, is in the defence. The defending for the first goal was sloppy off a set piece, and then they seemed very deep for the second one and not picking up the guy who arrived quite late into the box. It's a familiar tale, isn't it, Jim, with the England team? Why can't they sort out the defence?
Yeah, I think the problem also was that they weren't being very well shielded by the midfield. But Maguire and Keane are too similar, I think. That's the main problem. You know, they need John Stones back. They need a ball-playing centre-back. Maybe Tyrone Mings might be the man.
Yeah, it's been the problem. It's been the one obvious weakness in the Southgate sort of revolution over the last few years, is finding the right balance. And I sort of think Jordan Henderson, certainly at international level, he just sometimes if he's not got the right partner alongside him, it feels a bit slow. It feels a bit plodding in there. And I think deciding that balance in defence, everything will then, that will be the difference between whether we can realistically challenge at the Euros or whether, because I think everything then flows system-wise in terms of the personnel there from that. And that's the one weakness. And going back to what Mina was saying about the Euros, it's such, I think with the semi-finals at Wembley, the final at Wembley, where we were in the World Cup, where we've been in the year immediately after the World Cup, it's a massive opportunity. I think that it really is about the here and now at the moment.
And
I don't think you're going to get
Kane
many
and Sterling
chances like that again.
More or less at the top of their games, at perfect ages. It does seem like it's, you know, not now or never, but it's such a good opportunity this next Euros, isn't it?
Personally, no. I think that there is Sterling and Kane, and I think that it's a shame if they don't get to achieve success quite swiftly, but the rest of the team, I think, is quite young. I think there's still so much time to really make the most of Tammy Abraham, Mason Mount, all the players that can, Callum Hudson-Odoi, obviously, Jadon Sancho. I still think this is coming too early for them, personally speaking. And that's, you can see that in the way that what Gareth Southgate seems to be doing, he's under pressure every time there's a good youngster like Sacco, and he's like, oh, maybe I should call him up, or maybe I should call this one up, and maybe I should create this team that's sort of a little bit like Chelsea right now, that's making the most of all their youngsters. But I think for a lot of these, even Jadon Sancho, he's been terrific, but he started off in the Bundesliga last season as a bench player. Eventually he got his place, but it's still the Bundesliga, which is very offensively minded. It's not like he's coming up against the strongest of defences all day long. And he's figuring out ways of sort of defeating them. When it comes to defensive setups, we keep talking about, should it be Gomez? Should it be like all these different players? But I think that overall, there needs to be a balance there. Playing two players like Henderson and Rice, I think you need a third guy in there who's going to be strong on a defensive level as well. Perhaps this is where you need to copy the 4-3-3 of Liverpool, try to make it a gritty midfield, just so that it can offer a little bit more cover for the defence. The whole defensive unit needs to work as a unit, and starting from the top. You can't just blame the guys at the back. And you look at them, there isn't that much quality. Stones is a better player maybe to what Keane is, but he has problems setting up.
And he's not getting in the city, so.
No, and he's elaborate in everything that he does. You don't look at these centre-backs and think, yeah, you've got De Ligt and Virgil van Dijk. You don't have Chiellini and Bonucci, and you don't have, you know, Puyol. You don't have like a Ramos and a Piqué. So that's why the unity becomes the most important thing. And then when you have Kieran Trippier and other fullbacks that just charge forward, then you need to have a midfield that knows how to shield. And I don't think the tactics helped.
The other thing is that, you know, we've, in the last couple of years under the Southgate revolution, they've done very well. But whenever they've come up against a good team, they've not done well. You know, Croatia did them. Holland did them. Belgium did them. And, you know, Croatia, Holland and Belgium are going to be in the world, in the Euros, along with France, Germany and Spain. So, yes, it's a great opportunity that it's going to be. I think possibly they're going to have all their group games in England as well, plus the semi-finals and the final. I think our chances of getting to the quarterfinal are fairly limited, if we're being realistic.
Yeah, there's potentially problems with the seeding as well, isn't there, depending on how this group ends. Of course, we expect England to qualify, but possibly not with the unblemished record it was looking like. I just want to talk a bit about the mentality of the team. I wondered if this was not so much just about a tactical shortcoming against the Czech Republic, but was it a case of complacency? Did they fail to adjust to, you know, going ahead early and then conceding almost immediately afterwards?
I think that it is I think the big leap forward under Gareth Southgate has been around the mentality of the team. I don't think you can and I know I'm harking back a little bit to the World Cup, but I don't think you can underestimate the difference there is now around England and how that will give England a much better chance in the major competitions than previously. Taking that into in terms of the, I think it could be quite useful what's happened in the last few games, because they were on such a good run, and actually qualification has almost been so sort of straightforward that to have that this game, the game that was played at Southampton where it didn't really play that well, the Nations League, I think all of that, it might be just quite timely to have that at the moment. And I think there is a little bit of a danger of reading too much into these results, where qualification is, it was more or less been certain for quite a long time. I think that's, you know, I think you can read too much into the sort of, I think a lapse mentally is sort of forgivable and understandable, but the important thing is that the overall mentality and feeling around the England as a sort of thing to go off and do from your clubs is just completely different than it was 5 years ago.
Yeah, and also I think it's up to us to not exaggerate everything that happens. I feel like, you know, Spain got a draw against Norway. We've seen Germany lose. We've seen all the big teams lose. And I think that it's just a case of you should have a couple of these losses to bring you back down to reality, to know what you have to do, to realise, you know, where your strengths are, where your weaknesses are, how you should change going forward. I just don't know. I don't really understand the inquest. Like, it's just been 3 days of non-stop chat about how could they have failed. And you'd think they lost to San Marino. I mean, Czech Republic, that team is Slavia Prague, basically. So they know each other really well. And they all play for a team that got a point of Inter in the Champions League that made it really hard work for Borussia Dortmund to defeat them. They're not sort of just, you know, these walkovers either. They all know each other. They have a great dressing room harmony. The two fullbacks, two midfielders, all played for Slavia Prague. And that whole right side that was dominating Danny Rose, it plays together every day, so they know each other. So I feel like that makes a difference, and these things can happen. Every team can lose.
Yeah, they did play well. I wonder if some of the tenor of that inquest is just about journalists who've been with England for all of those disappointing World Cups, and it's just so depressing. Like, I watched it at home on Friday night and I thought, oh, here we go. This is such a familiar tale. Alone at home on a Friday night thinking, oh, I watch England, that'll be nice, and then being completely disappointed. disappointed. And I think that must just be terrible if you've travelled around with England for so many years. It just must be so familiar, and I think that comes out sometimes in the reporting.
Yes, there's a great story that our own Jason Burt tells of he went to a function with his wife, and Gareth Southgate was there, and it was soon after the World Cup. And Jason's wife was introduced to Gareth Southgate, and she said, "Thank you so much. My husband didn't come back miserable from an England event for the first time in 10 years. And I think, yeah, there is a certain degree of that. There was a sort of optimism which begins to dissipate. Going back to complacency, I think one of the things, and you know, I think Southgate does have issues, but I think he's a terrific coach. And one of the things about what he's done with England is, A, making it, as Jeremy said, a much more pleasant thing for the players to get involved in. But also there's no room for complacency anymore because he has changed things. I mean, you look at the way in which the team has developed since 2018. It's a very different team from the one that got to the World Cup semi-final. You know, players like Dele Alli and Jesse Lingard, who looked at that time to be absolutely integral for England for the next 10 years, they're not even in the squad. You know, he won't have any... I don't think he really gives grounds for complacency.
Mm. But do you think there's too much changes? Like, as in, if you are a team that perhaps don't have the quality, or the quality that you do have is still relatively young, do you think that maybe we should stick to sort of a foundation or certain principles that have worked in the past, so that the new ones that do come in aren't like thrown in at the deep end?
Well, I mean, I think that in this Euro qualification, he's been developing a new squad, a different squad, and, you know, they've all had opportunities. I suspect that in that there's been a process of development rather than chucking people in. I do think you're right, however. You know, I'm not sure about... He does seem to swap the fullbacks. I think that is a... That is one area in which English football seems to be blessed at the moment. And I'm not sure he seems to pick the best two that are available. But, you know, you always have complaints about
I think he had slightly, I think Mina's point, he has slight, the balance of change has been a bit, and he probably would acknowledge it himself, has possibly been a bit. I mean, if you take Mason Mount as an example, he's not even playing regularly in the Premier League at the start of the season. And suddenly, every step up he's taken, he's excelled, but it's to just assume that that's going to work is quite a big leap.
But you know, they hadn't lost in 10 years in a qualifier, haven't they? Maybe there's complacency in the selection and in how Southgate's approaching it, and maybe he's been a bit reckless not having Dele Alli in his squad, for example. I do wonder about the defence. Chris Waddle made a point on Five Live at the weekend that they're almost entirely out of form, the defenders. Butland, Rose, Maguire, Keane, Kieran Trippier, perhaps not so much. I don't watch much Atletico Madrid. There's got to be an argument for making some changes there, right?
I think that, again, for the defence, that what worries me is that there seems to be a disconnect between defence and offence. And I think that's something that he's trying to resolve. For example, I don't understand why it's so difficult on set pieces. We complain about Marco Silva, but then, you know, we have this issue as well. I'm not convinced of the quality that England have, the centre-backs. I think that where their quality is the full-backs. And the centre-back partnerships, I mean, Harry Maguire is a very good player, but yes, I do think that he's not really developing at Manchester United because they're going through a crisis. That's going to have an effect with him. It's going to have an effect when Gomez is not being played because Joel Matip is having the time of his life at the moment playing for Liverpool and doing a very good job of it. Keane might need to be dropped. And I'm not confident of Stones' ability to do the defensive work. Yes, he can build from the back, but he is so prone to error that it drives me crazy watching him. And the way that they all are, I don't think from a defensive point of view there's much development or anyone is there being trained by a coach who's going to be like, right, I'm going to take you under my wing and this is how we're going to teach you. So in terms of quality, I don't think it's there, which is why I think tactically it's important they get that right, how the team operate off the ball, which is, you know, how do they compress after they expand to attack? Can they compress? Are they good enough in the transitional phase, you know, to just quickly lose the ball, get back into shape at the right time? How are they being, you know, the midfield needs a lot more support. And I think that's how you can help it.
We will certainly get one change in the defence against Bulgaria on Monday night. Danny Rose is out with suspension. Presumably Ben Chilwell in for him. Do we expect any other changes, Jim, in that team?
Well, I wonder whether Keane will go. The problem
there's chat about Mings, isn't there, coming in for Keane?
Yeah, but the problem is that goes back to what Mina was saying, that you're chucking in somebody into a critical moment who's never played international football before.
Well, this is the thing. It doesn't matter. Like, either stick with it and just keep developing and then say, like, you know, the Euros is going to be throwaway because what we really care about is the World Cup, or we're building towards something. So we are going to try a lot of players. We are going to develop a lot of players. And we might lose certain matches, but we've got to be okay with that, the way that Chelsea said that as well on a club level. Either we do that or we say, no, actually, we're going to go gung-ho for this Euros. And that means that, you know, let's not rotate too much. Let's make certain sacrifices. Antonio Conte did that with Italy. He said, we're going to be a strong team, which means I'm leaving out Jorginho, I'm leaving out Bonaventura. I don't want creativity. I want a hard, disciplined team. And we're going to go that way because I want to do something in the Euros. You have to decide who you want to be.
I would like to see him try and settle pretty quickly, because I just think I completely understand Mina's point about the fact that we can see there's the potential of more to come, especially amongst that Chelsea group. But I just think Sterling, Kane, how often do England have world-class players in the last 20 years? Very rarely. And we know the correlation between playing at home, which this Euro is as close as we've had to playing at home for a long time. And then when you add in the sort of momentum and feel-good that there was around the World Cup, I just feel like this is a big opportunity next year.
Do we expect a response against Bulgaria?
I think so. Obviously, England defeated the Czech Republic pretty heavily at Wembley. I went to see them against Bulgaria, and they didn't look anything, Bulgaria, to me.
Bulgaria's awful. Sorry. I think they've lost. They haven't won in their last 10 games, have they?
They're full of sort of naturalised Brazilians who can't get a game for Brazil.
No. Marcelino is about the only one in midfield that didn't look hideous when they faced them last time. And he's probably the only player. They've got another one going forward, and they've got a 22-year-old as well going forward.
Wanderson they've got, isn't it?
Yeah, Wanderson. And then they have another one who's 22. He plays in Portugal.
Crower.
That's the one.
He scored on his debut against Porto,
which was huge.
Research points for Jim White.
But he is. Let me just say, before we get terrified about Crower, he is on loan at Vicente from Midgetland. That's how big a player he is.
I mean, you've ruined Bulgaria.
This feels like enormous pride.
Dimitar Berbatov, he isn't.
Oh dear.
So basically,
we're willing a Bulgaria victory into existence with this sort of chat.
Yeah, I've already put the kibosh on England. Suddenly he's going to become the most important player in Europe.
All right, let's really put the kibosh on something. What's your prediction for England at Euro 2020?
I think they'll get to the quarterfinals.
I'm an optimist. I think they're going to reach the final, but maybe there'll be someone. I do worry about Jim's point. We do tend to lose to good teams when we play them. There's quite a few in that tournament
as well.
I'm optimistic about it.
What are you saying, Mina?
Oh, I mean, I don't know. This hasn't changed anything. I thought it would be difficult for them to reach the quarters, and I still think that. I mean, I look at sort of Holland and Italy right now, and Belgium and France, and I'm like, oh, I don't know.
Yeah, it does feel like they're one unlucky draw away from football not coming home. Let's move on to talk about the rest of the teams in the British Isles. Wales came back after going behind to the World Cup finalist Croatia. It now means wins in Azerbaijan and at home to Hungary should get them through to the tournament, unless there's a shock elsewhere. Ryan Giggs under a bit of pressure, Jim, but this was a good, solid performance from Wales.
Yeah, to draw at home against Croatia isn't a bad result. I mean, you know, we know where Croatia have been in the past. And, you know, when you've got Bale, it's going back to what Jeremy is saying, you know, you've got Kane and Sterling for England. It does make a difference. Giggs has actually thrown in young players at the deep end in a way that he seems to have got away with slightly more than Gareth Southgate has, particularly in his defence. Mm.
Is it because expectations are lower, you think?
I don't think they're low in Wales. I mean, I think
this is their big chance.
This is their big chance as well. Yeah, I mean, you know, they've done well recently, Wales, and you know, last Euros was their great time.
Yeah, I covered Wales at the last Euros, and I think since then there was definitely a lull after not qualifying for the World Cup and Coleman going. And Coleman was a real galvanising influence around the place. His personality, as much as we can sort of pick holes in his club career, although he did well at Fulham at most of his time there. He was perfectly suited for international management because he was a sort of bubbly, interesting personality. The players loved him. Bale, important obviously to have Bale on board. Bale really, really liked him. And after he went, there was a bit, it really did feel a bit sad around the place. There was something was lost there. And it's taken Ryan Giggs a bit of time to... And I think it's possibly just about his best result at last night. But with watching them at the Euros, it was a lesson in if you're well organised, you've got good spirit, there's a sort of good buzz around things, and you've got a couple of players as they had in Bale and Ramsey.
I thought you were going to say Hal Robson-Kahn.
Particularly well, Hal Robson-Kahn.
He was amazing in that
certainly
tournament.
Certainly thought so. Anyway, he was a slight aside on him. He was always our sort of favourite interview because he certainly didn't lack for confidence in terms of where he was in the world strikers, and especially after that brilliant goal he scored against Belgium. But yeah, he's not Gareth Bale, but he had the belief that he belonged on that stage, which was fantastic for the team at that time, and he really thrived in that environment. But a well organised team with a couple of stars with good team spirit is hard to beat in a major tournament.
And they managed it without Aaron Ramsey.
There was an odd claim afterwards from Ryan Giggs that Dan James, who fell to the ground quite worryingly going up for a challenge, was actually play acting, and it did from the TV. And I know, you know, we can't really tell anything from looking at TV. It looked really bad. He sort of fell to the ground and went quite limp. James also said he didn't lose consciousness, but it didn't look good. You've done plenty, Jeremy, on concussions in football. Is it time for moments like this to be independently assessed rather than leaving it up to physios?
Yes, yeah, for a long time it has been, really. The two big things that football needs to do that it's obvious it needs to do and it will do eventually. It's one of those, it's almost like the goal line technology, obviously a far more serious situation. Everybody can see it's obvious it should happen, but it seems to take IFAB and FIFA a long time to do something which is obvious, which is... Have a much greater degree of independence in who makes the decisions. Doctors will privately tell you that clearly, even if with the best will in the world, there's going to be an indirect subconscious pressure to keep players on the pitch if you work for the team. Obviously, it's important that they're there because they know the players and they can speak to the independent medic. But in boxing, could you imagine if a cornerman had the final call rather than you had an independent doctor there? And then the other thing is these concussion substitutes, which we see in rugby. I understand it will probably get abused to some point, or there's a risk that it could get abused, which is a concern to football. But that's not really a particularly strong argument, that because there's another rule that some footballers or some coaches might try to manipulate to change things to their advantage, that you wouldn't introduce a sort of clear health thing so that you can just take players off. You can give them more than an on-field assessment in all the pressure and everything that's going on. You can take them off for 10 minutes and give them a longer assessment. It's still 10 minutes is still the science of concussion. It's still not long enough to really, but it's much better than 2 or 3 minutes on the pitch. And that's the key point. The Dan James one was quite alarming on two, whichever is the truth of what happened. Either it looked very clearly like he'd been knocked out, in which case he's had no business carrying on playing and shouldn't be playing for at least 6 days. He did get up and appear to obviously pass what concussion tests there are, which are fairly limited on the pitch. And then Ryan Giggs said afterwards that he was play acting. Now, whatever the explanation, that's a big problem as well, if that's the truth of the thing. Because
what a weird thing for Giggs to admit to.
And if you've got players doing that, then if doctors and referees have got to then factor in the possibility that players will play act, then you're in a way you're undermining the whole concussion protocol and endangering people going forward if you're going to cry wolf over something as serious as that. So whatever the explanation, it wasn't a good outcome of what happened.
let's leave that slightly murky and unpleasant ground behind and head to the year 2001, where Mick McCarthy's Ireland's top Group D. a frustrating goalless draw in Georgia for Ireland, but one win sees them through. They play Switzerland next. Do we expect Ireland to be in Euro 2020, Jim? They, of course, will be hosting some of it.
Yeah, I think they will. And Mick McCarthy back. It's fantastic. It's great to see. You know, as you say, it takes us back to those days when Ireland managed to bestride the world, largely on the backs of Mick finding the passports of great-granddads, which was always helpful.
But I mean, I am a little bit worried in the sense that the two that they have to get a win against either Switzerland or who is it on, if they don't, Denmark, right? Two of the higher ranked teams. And if they play any way like they did against Georgia, if Georgia were actually clinical or in converting their chances, I mean, there was no pressing game to be seen. Their passing game was very poor. I don't know. There could be a, there could be reason to believe that one of those two, you know, they won't manage that one win that they need.
Scotland versus San Marino, thank goodness, was not a new worst chapter ever in the bleak story of Scottish football. Steve Clarke saying he wants Scotland to aim for third in their group, modest aims, and so they go into the playoffs with a bit of confidence. But did you watch any of this game? Did you see how wet it was?
It was awful. I don't even know how it was allowed to go on. I just think no one wanted to come back, so they're like, we're just going to continue with this game.
Yeah.
But going back to Mina's point about Ireland, Scotland, Wales, the issues are slightly mitigated by the fact they've got Gareth Bale. But it's all, you know, the consequence of the Premier League bringing in ever more players from around the world, isn't it? And the Championship now, players from around the world, you know. So the number of Irish players coming to the Premier League is few and far between, and the Scots the same. You know, I know they've obviously got Champions League potential with Celtic and Rangers, but there just aren't the numbers that there were, and it's, you know, it's now becoming a real struggle for these countries to get through because they just haven't got the quality.
I'd love
anymore
to see Scotland get through, because I just think it's one of the, and I don't have the, unfortunately I don't have the answer to the question, but I think it's one of the most interesting questions of what's happened to Scottish football in the last 20, 30 years, where you've got those giants like Rangers and Celtic, which are still giants. If there was ever a European Super League, suddenly Rangers and Celtic would be in the top, I don't know, top eight, top six, maybe more British clubs, because they would be, if you, clubs like that or Ajax, if you put them in a Super League and they would then had the television revenue with the support they've got and the interest around them, the potential there is enormous. And the fact that sort of culturally football's such a big thing in Scotland, the fact that that's not translated into producing players like they did previously, I think is a fascinating question, of which I don't have I've not looked into enough to sort of give an intelligent answer to.
It's just remarkable that they were such perennial qualifiers for international tournaments, and it's been more than 20 years now since they've
been
in. Look
at the players they produced in the past, like great, you know, great footballers.
And you would have thought they would have fluked their way into one, though. It seems unusual.
Just the Premier League, that's clearly part of the answer, but you know, Wales have produced some very good footballers in the last few years, and you think why can't, and even if they've ended, they would end up coming down to England. It's as a lot of them did in the sort of 80s. I'm not saying there's been no good footballers, but that there hasn't been that sort of any very very few really elite footballers from Scotland I think it's a really interesting question.
And it's the irony of that is it's come at the same time when Scottish coaching is now regarded as really, really top notch. So, you know, loads of coaches from around Europe go to Scotland to do their qualifications because the coaching system's really good there. So, you know, that's another just peculiarity of it. They've got terrific coaches, but for some reason they're not getting terrific players.
Is it that sort of the rest of Europe have stepped up their game in the sense that now Iceland is somebody to worry about, and that you have all these other teams just sort of really Belgium coming into their own, you know, whether it's Serbia or Bosnia or Croatia, you're sort of always, you know, they produce so much quality. And I don't know whether there's just so much competition now that a lot of teams have fallen off. I mean, whenever would you ever hear of a World Cup without Italy and Holland?
Yeah, sad days. Let's go back to domestic football now and look forwards to the Premier League next weekend. Manchester United versus Liverpool rather stands out on the fixture list. Is this the sort of game, Mina, where history and rivalry can galvanise a team like United who are struggling, or are Liverpool just too good for any of that at the moment?
Oh, it'd be nice to have like something of a shock, just for Solskjaer, you feel so sorry for him standing there on the sidelines. But Paul Pogba's not going to come back. I think they're still going to have their problems. I mean, Liverpool are just too good at this moment in time for me to foresee any sort of shock there.
What's the fan mood like at Old Trafford, Jim? Are they still on Solskjaer's side?
The match-going fans still sing his name. He's such an unimpeachable hero from his playing days. But I think he's got an issue. I think a lot of the fans recognise that he, in a sense, is powerless because of the institutional problems that there are at the club. I mean, absolutely, literally, the roof is falling in. At the Arsenal game, there was so much rain coming through the roof of the South Stand that they had to move people away because there has been an institutional lack of investment into that club. Yet, on the other hand, they've got the biggest wage bill in English football last year. Normally, the biggest wage bill puts you to the top. But they're so incompetent that they came sixth with the biggest wage bill. How does that happen? And so, you know, he has got to start making this team sing. And I don't think I've been watching United for far longer than I'm prepared to admit on this podcast. And I don't think I've ever seen such a hollow squad as they've got at the moment.
Why isn't
now, the manager must have a responsibility there as well.
Why isn't there more unrest? It feels like the only sustained period when the fans turned was the yellow and green scarves era. Is there not a sense that there should be some organisation here about exactly what you're saying, the structural problems, the clear issues?
Yes, I think that Solskjaer does paper over a lot of those cracks because there's also a kind of, as there would be at many other clubs, we've got to stick behind the manager here. We've got to.
But it was Ferguson was in charge when it was the yellow and green scarves.
Yeah, but that was a different era. They were winning everything. It was easier. You know, this is a crisis. You've got to stand by the manager. And my fear for Solskjaer is that the level of institutionalized incompetence at the club is such that he will take the fall. He will be the fall guy. They'll be firing him rather than ever looking at their own incompetence.
Well, this is why. Why don't they do the protests against Ed Woodward? You know, why don't they just go crazy and throw all these, you know, jets and planes up above saying, you know, get rid of this man? Because I would go crazy if this guy is still in power, paying all these wages, you know, giving Sanchez away for free and selling Lukaku and whoever it is. And then, I don't know. Jeremy,
I was going to say something fairly similar. That I never thought Solskjaer was a good choice. I thought it was like the one inspired thing that we could say Ed Woodward did was as a stopgap, and then you thought, it got a bit of momentum going, and he's going to properly go for Pochettino. There's a plan here, and only Ed Woodward could then still make a mess of it. And you think, how did he? He'd done something slightly inspired with Solskjaer, and then you presumed he was going to move everything to get Pochettino, as he seems to do if there's a player they want. And then he just did, and then he sort of made this terrible decision of just got carried away with all the sort of emotion and excitement. And I'm not, you know, I said this without trying to be like, I wrote, but because you always, if you say this on Twitter, everyone would, oh, it's easy to say that now. But I wrote a piece at the time saying, why are they giving Solskjaer the job? I didn't, he was great for one problem, yeah. But he wasn't the obvious answer for the second problems. And the overall thing of Manchester United, it almost seems pointless talking about Solskjaer, because the Woodward issue in terms of the transfer, his job is presumably the transfers and the selection of managers, and you would score him sort of, you know, what can you say about that since David Gilt went, and how the Glazers aren't looking at that fairly critically and identifying what seems to be the issue there is
it's making money, right?
Yeah, it's all fine as long as the balance sheet is you know, trending in the right direction.
As long as you're making money, yeah.
What about your Saints, Jeremy? Off to Wolves this week, and it's been a bit of an uneven start to their season. Yeah. Are the fans still backing Hasenhüttl?
I think Hasenhüttl's is popular, and he's the reason for some optimism. I think more widely, there's quite a few signs of sort of concern, because it wouldn't have made massive headlines, but the director of football operations, Ross Wilson, left today, and he's a big player, but very big player, probably the biggest off field in terms of transfers, managerial selection. He is the sort of worked under Paul Mitchell when they were very clever on the recruitment, and he's grown into this bigger role was the new Les Reed. He's had the option to go to Rangers for a long time. He's a Scottish guy, and he's decided to go. And that the message that sends, there's not really been a lot of investment since the Chinese ownership have come in. Hasenhüttl kept the club up really by getting rid of players in January. He kind of obviously felt that there were some people that weren't a great influence on the overall feel he wanted at the training ground. No one came in January when he turned it around. He just got rid of a few people. There's not really been any investment since the Chinese came in. So I think the wider picture, quite a few people, Les Reed, Ralph Kruger, and now Ross Wilson, sort of three of the most senior off-field people have left in the last year. The Chinese have not, new owners have not really, there doesn't seem that they're going to inject any funds. So it feels like Hasenhüttl is the one key that he retains sort of interest and faith in the wider project, because I lost a few games in a row, quite hard fixtures so far. I think the squad is okay enough to stay up, but the sort of wider mood around the club, I think there's a few sort of bad signals there.
Trouble brewing potentially. Listen to that lovely European music. It's the national anthem of the Mediterranean region, Mina, which can only mean it's time for a song for Europe. European international football. France win in Iceland, thanks to Olivier Giroud, but his Chelsea teammate Kante was injured in the warm-up. Are France still the best team in Europe at the moment, Mina?
Yeah, I think so. I still think they're the best team in Europe. I mean, they obviously had to do this without Mbappe, they had to do this without Pogba and without Kante. They're still a terrifying prospect, but even they suffered defeat against Turkey, for example, in June. And tonight they play them, so I think that's going to give us even more signals whether or not Turkey is going to destroy them with a centre-back who was 20 years old, who we bought because of that, and Juventus. But they are a very good team. Weirdly enough, for all their beauty, they're not that concerned with necessarily always extolling the virtues of that talented squad, but more sometimes are quite cautious in the way that they play. I still think they are very much, other than Spain, but Spain's manager, Leicester, you trust in France.
Interesting you don't mention Italy and Belgium, who are the only two sides with perfect records in qualifying. Are you just not having them?
Belgium, I've never had. I've been one of the few people that has been like, I just don't get it. Like, as in, yeah, their squad is talented. Again, they don't really have a sort of legacy in Belgium. I think that makes a difference. Sorry, I know that.
They're quite golden generation England,
aren't
they?
It is a golden generation. Their defence is not that great, and they've never had a great manager, and I still don't even trust in Martinez. I think that you have people that can resolve problems, like obviously Eden Hazard. But other than that, you sort of look at that team and you think it's more a bunch of individuals put into a team unit, and they play very good football, but they are susceptible to a scare, like Japan in the World Cup. And right now, I don't know how to judge them, because they're just defeating teams that are like 9-0 and they're really bad teams, you know, like Kazakhstan or whatever it is. And I'm not going to, I don't know how to judge them, because Ian Martinez for me is not a problem solver. As for Italy, it's a change in culture. They've gone from being a very pragmatic team to one that now tries to dominate midfields. And when you change skin like that, you can have moments of, you know, beauty like Italy have had in their qualifying campaign, but there's a potential that they don't actually have a great striker that can convert all these chances. And I'm still not confident of the defence, because this isn't a pragmatic team.
Let's stay in Italy. Claudio Ranieri back in our lives again, appointed as Sampdoria manager. Is he well regarded in Italy, or at least liked?
Oh, he's totally loved, you know, in much the same way that he's loved over here. But I think it's quite funny because now there's going to be a couple of memes with Eusebio Di Francesco, who was the Roma coach, and then Ranieri replaced him at Roma. And now he got the job at Sampdoria, and now Ranieri's replaced him at Sampdoria. So I just feel like there's always this shadow of Ranieri looming over him. But he's sort of considered a safe pair of hands, a little bit old school. So never really going to be given probably a club to build stuff with.
Is he Sam Allardyce?
Yes, Sam Allardyce. He's the guy that's always going to get the right results, but he's not necessarily going to be the guy who gives you the fantastic football that Sarri can, or that, you know, or the mentality that Conte can. So he's sort of just considered, you know, like good, but not for this new evolution that we're seeing in Italian football, where everyone's very progressive, you see.
I see.
Chiellini, as he said, Pep's ruining Italian football.
Finally, after a spate of sackings in the Football League this week, I want to know from each of you, when is the best time in the season to sack a manager? What do you reckon, Jim?
I did an interview with Jim Bentley, who is the longest serving manager in the Football League, 91 clubs in the Football League, longest serving manager. He became the longest serving manager after 7 years in the job. That just speaks really? For how short term it is. 7 years he became the longest serving manager. He's been there a bit longer since then. But I remember speaking to a manager who was out of work. And he said, the time that you start getting yourself on the radio, start doing punditry, start getting yourself talked about is between the two international breaks, because that's when chairmen tend to sack managers. They tend to do it. It's the old burying bad news. I suspect there'll be a couple of managers sacked today.
Really?
Yeah, because England are playing and, you know, push it under the carpet and across the Football League I'm talking about.
Interesting.
So they will and then bring in someone for the weekend. It tends to be around this time, and I think it's because you've had a bad start, there's still time to put it right, get a new manager in. It also gives them time to prepare for a transfer window. So if I was a chairman, I'd be looking to sack him about now.
What do you reckon, Jeremy?
It's really interesting. The logical thing, obviously, would be to do it in the summer. And I suppose you could argue that Brighton, if you see problems that you think are there that no one's seen already, there's a certain, I'm not saying that particular decision was right or wrong, but there's a certain logic to being clean about when you do it rather than go into a season with doubts. And it's obviously logical to do it around now, so you've got the transfer window. I always think that you get that surge with a new manager, so maybe there's an argument to do it quite late in a season, which is quite risky because you then get the little surge and then okay, you might have to regroup in the summer. I don't know what they're right. I think the hallmark of a well thinking run club is probably that they will make their changes in the summer if they can. But
if you're Oldham Athletic, you have to do it three or four times a year. So you can't talk about the best time of year because it happens so often.
Or you have an Italian owner.
So punishingly cold at Boundary Park and no one wants to stay there for too long. What about you, Mina?
It depends. If it's a big club, then I'd say probably now, so that the whoever comes in can create something special for the Champions League knockout stages. If you're a small club and you're really fighting off relegation, then maybe around February, so you can have that little lift that will push you forward.
Okay, well argued. Congratulations, Mina. You've won that question. That's your lot for this week. You can contact me on Twitter next week, or now, up to you. At Tom with an H Gibbs is where to go on that website. Don't forget to send us an email as well, afcpodcast@telegraph.co.uk. Please do. We love emails. Why not? It's a treat for you, a treat for us. We'll read out the best of what you send us. Don't forget to subscribe to the podcast. Search for Telegraph Audio Football Club wherever you get your podcasts. It's on Spotify. Who knew? Thanks to Joel Grove on the buttons, and thanks to you for your company. I'll talk to you again soon.
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.